episode 34 of this little podcast we've titled Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here with my ever-literate co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hello, Perry. Ever-literate, that's a new aphorism or a new description. That's very interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Perfectly accurate for you, David. I mean, most of the work that you do does seem to be undertaken in the literary world. So, a lot of your hobbies are the same way. So that's all. Not necessarily all of them, but some of them.
The things I'm doing for Standard E-books seems to fall into that category because I'm reading a lot of classic literature.
Mm. Yep. So how's the lockdown going? Second week of curfew. You're not out clubbing. You're not missing the clubbing at down the nightclubs.
No, the rave parties or anything like that. I'm living a very quiet life now. But however, it's not for hasn't
really
actually changed.
Curtailed your life, though.
Hasn't really changed, to be honest.
not for me either. To be perfectly frank, I mean, I miss going out to restaurants and catching up with people, but. It's something that we need to endure and we need to get through. We're now 2 weeks through stage four. We have another 4 weeks to go. So that's going to end up being a little bit difficult because we're currently coming up to the time in midweek, in a couple of days' time, when we would have been out of our original stage three lockdown. But with the number of coronavirus cases increasing quite markedly here in the state of Victoria and also the number of deaths from the virus, the state government decided to institute a state of emergency and move it into stage four 2 weeks ago.
Yes, well, hopefully the numbers do seem to be trending down, at least not coming down in a hurry, but they're slowly trending down.
Yeah, they're starting to get there. So it's starting to move down towards where we really wanted to get to. But it's also giving us a lot of time to catch up on reading that we haven't been doing, which we will get to later on. But there's a couple of things that we need to fix from last episode, David, when we were talking about the 1963 Hugo Awards. Mm-hmm. We've actually got listeners.
Yes, who
actually wrote in and told us we were wrong,
which
great.
Is the purpose of listeners, isn't it, really?
Yes. Well, actually, they didn't really tell us, sort of wrong. I'll explain. First off, and I think this was you, David. I'm sorry to have to tell you this.
Yes. But
we were talking about the short fiction, and we came across a particular entry that by the title of Myra, and we didn't actually mention who wrote it.
Indeed, we didn't.
Which is a bit disappointing on our behalf, but it was written by a gentleman by the name of Gary Jennings, of whom I know absolutely nothing other than the fact that he wrote this particular story. I don't know whether he got nominated again. Maybe he did. We'll come across him if he did. The other thing that I mentioned in the 2020 Hugo discussion regarding the novel, when I was talking about what the results were, and also about the records that have been released regarding the nominations that were received for the final ballot, I mentioned that Anne Leckie's novel, The Raven Tower, had received enough nominations to make it onto the ballot, but that she had declined, and I didn't know why. Well, I subsequently found an entry from her blog, and then somebody else, Mark Plummer, pointed it out to me about the same blog entry, that she declined it on the basis that she thought that it was time for somebody else to have a go in this particular year. But she did emphasise the fact that this is not a blanket denial of nominations into the future. If she feels that she wants to have a particular work nominated or to appear on the ballot, if it receives enough nominations, she will make a decision on a case-by-case basis. And that seems fair enough. I can perfectly understand that. For people that are not particularly aware of how the process works, all of the nominations are received by the very much arm-length subcommittee, as you all know, David, as you were it.
I was.
In 1975, that the Hugo Awards subcommittee is completely at arm's length from the rest of the committee. And they receive all of the nominations, they tally them up, And then in this day and age, it's a lot easier because you can do it all via email. They contact the particular authors or creators of the work and ask them if they would like to appear on the ballot. It's at that time that the author or creator is allowed to decline the nomination. Sometimes we've had situations where particular authors may have two or three stories in the one category on the ballot, and they may then decide that it is a good idea just to drop one of them to give them what they would consider to be the better choice a much greater chance of being able to win the award. And that also makes perfect sense. Although there have been times when there have been an author with two or three on the ballot and have just decided to stay with it and just see what happens. Again, that's also quite reasonable. There's no rule to say that you can't have more than one entry on a particular category. I think Sina Maguire at one year had nominations at every length in the big four, you know, novel, novella, novelette, and short story. So that was quite interesting. She may be the only one that's done that. Oh no! If I start saying that, I'll get into trouble again. And
we shouldn't make any claims. That's the only one or the first one, as we discovered again, didn't we?
Oh, we'll all basically get into trouble. But the way I look at this, David, is that this is like a discussion over a beer.
Yeah.
We've got to make blanket statements sometimes. We've got to make mistakes. We're quite happy to correct them, and it's quite good that people are listening and actually listening close enough to be able to tell us that we've made mistakes, similarly to the next one that we did. So we did three last week, last episode. That was pretty good. I made big play of the fact that Marion Zimmer Bradley's book, The Sword of Alderney, was the first time that a woman had appeared on the Hugo novel ballot. That was incorrect, given that either earlier this year or late last year, I had already mentioned that Leigh Brackett in 1956 was the first to appear with The Long Tomorrow. I think what happened in that situation is that the website that I was checking Zimmer Bradley's categorization in terms of being the first actually doesn't list those nominations for that particular year in which Brackett appeared. Those nominations only came out two or three years ago, and I think it's probably still a little bit contentious. Anyway, it's in history. Let's just say that Brackett was the one and move on, and I think we'll all be happy, although somebody will write to us and say, no, that's not right. According to the long list of Hugo Awards, she's not on it. Anyway, we'll take it that she is and sort of move on from that, David. I think that's probably the best way of doing things.
It was Kim Hewitt who told us of our mistake there, and he's occasionally told us of other mistakes we've made in the past. He's actually a very good researcher into issues, Fanish, and things to do with the Hugo Awards, and we'll put a link in the show notes to something he's written about the Hugo Awards, and we'll try and do better in future.
We will, but I'm absolutely certain that we will hear a lot more from the listeners about other mistakes that we're going to make.
So there we go. So you've been doing some reading, Perry.
Yes, David.
And so is it all science fiction, or have you moved away from science fiction?
Moved away from it this time. We've been doing a lot of science fiction over the last couple of months. Time for me to catch up. I think it really does look as though my reading year goes with the first 6 months or so, which is pretty solidly aimed at catching up on the Hugo ballot stuff, trying to guess what's going to appear and read that first, and then when the Hugo packet comes out, to finish off doing all the rest of the reading for that particular year. So a lot of the first 6 months is to do with science fiction, and then the second part of the year I try to catch up with all the bits that I really want to read and haven't had a chance to, and then later on in the year start moving towards thinking about what's going to go on the Hugo ballot for 2021.
Oh,
so it's always there, it's always in the back of your mind, but it's always good to sort of move away. You get a little bit more perspective here.
You might
recall later last year or earlier this year, I was talking about how I do like going back and reading a lot of, well, not a lot of, but some old crime novels that have been written quite some time ago, trying to get a bit of perspective on the field, trying to see how the whole thing sort of all comes together. And the first one that I want to talk about today is a book by an author called Josephine Tay. This book is The Man in the Queue. This is the first of her Inspector Alan Grant series of novels, of which there were about six. Now, Josephine Tay, this book, by the way, was written in 1929, and that is actually important for something that's going to be coming up in a minute. Josephine Tay is probably best known for as being the author of The Daughter of Time, a book that you've probably read. And I think you've actually read this particular book as well, I believe, David.
Yes,
Yeah, okay. Well, The Daughter of Time is another one of her Inspector Alan Grant stories where he's holed up in a hospital with a broken leg. Somebody brings him in a copy of a postcard from the National Portrait Gallery in London, which shows Richard III. In that particular book, Alan Grant sets out to solve the mysteries of the princes in the tower. And The Daughter of Time has always been considered to be one of the probably top half dozen crime novels ever written anywhere. So that's fairly high praise. And so I was interested to go back and have a look at some of the earlier ones dealing with Alan Grant, written by Josephine Tay. Now, in this particular, this is the very first one that she wrote. So I think that the fact that it is the first one she wrote becomes a bit obvious later on in the book. Now, the basic plot is that Grant, who's an inspector for Scotland Yard in London, and again, don't forget, this is the 1920s, is searching for the identity of a man who has been stabbed to death in a London theatre queue. The odd thing about this is that there's a big rush on near the end of or coming up to a performance of a particular play. And there's a huge crowd of people there, all sort of pushing in to go towards the box office. This gentleman's been stabbed in the back with a dagger. And the press of the crowd is such that he's maintained upright until he gets to the box office, when suddenly he just gets there, the person in front of him steps away, and he falls flat on his face, and there he is. Everybody screams, the police are brought in, and so on. So, but nobody knows who he is because there's no identification on him at all. And nobody knows who he is. And then Grant basically starts to his investigation in terms of who was in the queue, who was involved, who this person, tries to track down who this particular person is. This is a really solid police procedural. It's got some very strong writing in it, very good views of the London theatre world. And it's got a lot of literary overtones in it. And a couple of times, actually, the author herself says, "I don't know what happened here," because, and something, and then just moves on. And you think, that's a bit postmodern, isn't it? You know, in the sense of having the author imposing herself into it, saying that she does not know this particular piece of information, but then carries on with what it is that she seems to know. Now, you normally would have thought that in the 1920s, the omnipotent narrator, the author, would know everything about the particular story. But in this instance, that was a nice little quirk, I thought, that was in this. So you get a really good view about how the police would go about trying to identify a person in the 1920s, how they would basically try to track down all of the people that had been in the queue, and so on. So Grant finally figures out who this particular person is, and he realises that the guy was leaving the next day to go to America. So that might have been something to do with why it was murdered. He doesn't have anything on him at all, no money, nothing whatsoever. Is it a robbery? They don't think so. They find out that he's a bookmaker, and they track down his clerk, who seems to have done a runner. Now, there's a really interesting thing here that when people in the 1920s wanted to run somewhere where they could hide and never be found, it always seemed to be Scotland. Because if you remember the 39 Steps,
yes,
the same sort of thing happens there. He scoots up towards the Yorkshire Moors and up into Scotland and tries to get away. And the same sort of thing follows here. Look, this is a really good, solid detective story all the way right through till around about the last two or three chapters, and then sort of falls apart for me. I mean, I suddenly you find out that the person that you thought that it was going to, that was going, that had committed the murder probably didn't, and then somebody else turns up just out of the blue. And then it's all solved and all wrapped up. And you think,
yeah, that's not good.
No, it didn't. Look, there's so much to like about this particular book in terms of the first instance, but it almost gives you the view that she got to the point when she was about two chapters out and thought, I don't like this solution. It's too obvious. I know. I'll just pull something out of my hat.
Yeah.
So she does, which leaves you a little bit disappointed. But look, there's a lot of, as I said, there's a lot of good things to like. There's a lot of good things about the police procedural. There's a lot of good location stuff regarding the London theatre scene and London itself and Scotland as well. So there's a lot of good things about this, but it just falls down at the end. So I gave this a 3.4 out of 5. Not keeping it under, just wanted to, it's almost up to a 4, but not quite. And so if I gave it 3.5, it'd round up to 4. Couldn't do it, so I had to leave it at 3.4. But look, it'll be one of those ones that I will be... Look, it'll be one of those series that I'll keep going with.
Yep.
I think, because I know that she gets to the point with The Daughter of Time, which is, I don't know, number 5 or something in this particular series, that by the time she gets there, she's really on top of her form and knows what she's doing. Just with this one, not quite.
Sure.
Not quite.
Yeah. You probably like her book, The Franchise Affair, which I think is technically an Alan Grant novel, but he only sort of appears very briefly in it. But that's really quite a clever sort of story. And I won't go into the details now, but yeah, if you're reading through her work, then don't miss that one.
All right.
The Franchise Affair.
Okay, do that.
Yeah. Well, like you, I've been reading mostly... This whole episode is going to be an all-crime episode, I think. I've been really reading mostly crime since we left off with the science fiction. And indeed, the book I'm going to talk about first is a book by a science fiction author, which is a crime novel. So this came up in my discussion with Rob Durand about Jack Vance, and he enthused quite a bit about Jack Vance's crime novels, and he particularly mentioned this one, which is called The View from Chickweed's Window, which was written in 1979. So I'll try to summarize the plot as quickly as I can. The book starts in 1907, when a priceless Sung Dynasty vase is stolen from a delegation of the Japanese trade mission, and it comes into the possession of Harry Botham, who is a partner in a firm working in Shanghai in China. Now, Harry Botham has got two daughters, Fiona and Ruth, Fiona being the elder. Fiona marries this chap in 1926 called Maurice Brewer, and who is the son of her father's business partner. And Harry Botham, as a wedding present, gives them a round the world tour, fully paid for. In 1928, the younger daughter marries a penniless Methodist missionary called Kenneth Enright, who's stationed in Japan. And this couple are not interested in travelling, so as a wedding gift, Harry Botham gives her the Sung Dynasty vase. And this is to the utter fury of the older daughter, Fiona, who'd always had her eyes on this vase. Both couples have children. Fiona has two sons and moves to America. And Ruth gives birth to her daughter, Llewellyn, in Japan in 1940. Now, obviously, 1940, you're starting to think what's going to happen with the war. And indeed, in 1941, the Pacific War breaks out. So Ruth, her husband, and her tiny daughter are interned by the Japanese in Japan. And while in the internment camp, Ruth dies of pneumonia. But the husband and the child survives, and they remain in Japan after the war comes to an end. He's still doing his missionary work. So anyway, in 1948, which is when Llewellyn, or Lulu for short, is 8 years old, her father is actually dying, and he sends her to America to live with her Aunt Fiona, and she takes with her this precious vase. But as soon as she arrives, literally as soon as she arrives, her aunt rapidly searches her baggage and takes the vase into her custody. She's finally got the vase. And Lulu's a bright, precocious sort of child, but Fiona is really cold to her. And her two cousins, Kendall and Oliver, are horrible little boys. They're malicious and they torment her. And this kind of behaviour isn't anything new for them, because they've for years been tormenting a sick and disabled boy who lives next door. And though we never find out his real name, they call this boy Professor Chickweed, because they often see him through the fence sitting down and writing in a journal, some sort of book. And Chickweed has a cat, which often strays into their yard, in which they also torment. And indeed, Kendall frequently threatens to shoot it with his .22 rifle. And it's not long before we see that Fiona's husband, Morris, is starting to make sexual advances to young Lulu, so he's a paedophile. And she's, of course, terrified by these approaches. And she tries to tell Fiona about it, but as is often the case, her Aunt Fiona indignantly refuses to listen to any of this. Anyway, one day with the boy, when Lulu's out in the yard with the boys, things come to a head, and Kendall is determined to shoot Chickweed's cat. And Lulu wrestles the gun away from him just as Morris comes into the yard. The gun goes off and Morris falls to the ground. And then Lulu is accused of murder and convicted. She's only 8 years old, and sent off to juvenile detention, where she spends some 9 years. But while in detention, she works hard at her studies and begins to put herself through college. And she makes a friend there called Robert. While she's there, she receives a registered letter from Japan from her deceased father's solicitors. As a letter that's been held in trust for her until she turns 18. And in the letter, her father tells her that he'd sent her Aunt Fiona an amount of $12,000 to be invested for Lulu's future. This money, of course, never comes to Lulu, and so she begins to plan her revenge with the help of this friend Robert. So that's the background and how they achieve this revenge, which is very sweet, and they recover the money, humiliate Aunt Fiona and the two boys, and then they recover the Sung Dynasty vase. And what all this has got to do with Chickweed's window is really the heart of the rest of the story. But it's cleverly done. It's really engaging. You're really rooting for Lulu to get her revenge on these horrible people. And indeed she does. So it's a very entertaining story, well written. It has, when you think about some of Jack Vance's other work, he obviously has a thing for revenge. He likes revenge stories and people getting their comeuppance, their deserved comeuppance. And that's a theme through a lot of his books. So I'm thinking of the Demon Princes series, which is entirely a series about someone getting their revenge for the murder of his parents.
Revenge is always a good motive.
It's a good motive, yeah. So, but no, I enjoyed it a lot. I was glad I read it, and I'll be looking to read some more of his crime novels.
Well, good. Okay, that's one to look out for. I'm moving to an Australian novel. Now, I mentioned this particular book, Beat Not the Bones, by Charlotte Jay, sometime last year,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, I do remember you talking about it.
Because we were talking about it in terms of the history of Australian crime writing, because this particular book is quite important for a couple of reasons. One is that it won the very first Edgar Award in 1954. Mm. These awards are given out by the Mystery Writers of America. Her win in 1954 was followed the year after by The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler. So you get the view about what sort of level of quality we're talking about here, because The Long Goodbye is a fantastic book. This one's not at that standard, but it has some very, very interesting things about it. Now, before I go into it, I think this is possibly, and I read somewhere that somebody said, this is the very first mystery novel ever set in Papua. We're not talking Papua New Guinea here, because this is before everything's been joined up. So there was Papua and there was New Guinea. So it's quite, and it's only the second book, I think, that I've ever read, which is set on that particular island, and the other one being The Visitants by Randolph Stowe that I read earlier this year. So it's not a part of the world that really gets represented in literature, well, Western literature, terribly much. And so from that perspective, it's got a sense of, there's a sense of interest here. Let's see what this particular woman has written. Now, Charlotte Jay wrote about 8 or 9 novels under that particular name, which was a pseudonym. She also wrote a number of novels under her original name, Geraldine Hall, I think it is, and that was probably 6 or 7 of those. So she didn't write a lot, and this was only her second ever novel. And so hopefully we've got quite a good piece on offer, and we really do have quite a good book. It's very slow to get started, but once you get into it, it sort of starts to roll a bit in the second half of the book. So anyway, the basic outline is that a young woman by the name of Stella Warwick arrives in Papua, ostensibly to start a new job with the Australian administration that's there. Because don't forget, we're talking here, this book was written in 1952, so probably that it was released mainly in America in 1953. So therefore, it was picked up for the 1954 Edgar Award. So it's written in 1952. Australia is running Papua as a territory, basically a protectorate. They're running all of the administration, looking after all of the finances, all of the foreign affairs, all the health, all the public service. They're looking after all of it, trying to, ostensibly trying to employ the local Papuans to fill in a number of the roles and gradually learn the business. But you learn very quickly that all of the Australians there are, they're either one of two types. They've either gone completely over onto the Papuan side and are trying to assimilate themselves as best they can, or they're as racist as all hell. And they run it as a really strong colonial sort of government of exploitation and just treating them like dirt, basically. They're all basically primitive savages as far as these people are concerned. And so you're getting a very strong anti-colonial view right from the very beginning in this particular book. That was put to Jay at a later time, and she hadn't realised that she was as strong on that line as she thought, as other people thought. But to me, it was bleedingly obvious that this is a very strong anti-colonial piece. Anyway, Stella Warwick turns up to get a job working for the administration. But her real reason for going is to investigate the death of her husband, David, who has died upcountry in what has been dubbed a suicide. Now, she doesn't believe that he committed suicide. She hadn't known him for all that long while she was married, and then he moved to Papua for work, and he's in the cultural affairs area. He basically went upcountry, didn't ever come back. The people that he went with all basically said, oh, no, he committed suicide, and that was all there was to it. She doesn't believe this. She turns up without telling anybody, but she has a job with the administration and starts trying to figure out what actually happened to him. Everybody that she meets misleads her, lies to her, treats her badly. Then when they realise who she is, they treat her even worse, and she basically can't make headway. They don't tell her things that she really needs to know to be able to work out what was going on. And she finally decides that the only way that she's going to be able to solve the mystery of her husband's death is to take the same journey that he did up into the country of Papua to find out where he died. Now, the major difficulty that she has in this regards is that most people don't want to go with her, though she does finally convince that one person to go with her that was with her husband, or two people that were with her husband on the trip, one Papuan and one Australian. Well, the Australian guy is a real deeply weird gentleman, and you are very suspicious of him all the way right through. The Papuan who went there is, and he and the porters that go along with them, because there's only a couple, are all scared stiff of this particular village because it's got a reputation of being full of sorcerers who basically, you know, point the bone and basically kill people left, right and centre if they don't like them. So she has to journey up into the country dragging this Australian along with her to try to find out what happens. And she does finally determine what happened to her husband. I'm not going to tell you what that is because that'd be a spoiler. And I really don't think very many people these days have read this particular book. And I think that it's a very good thing for people to read. Mm. There are actual shades of the Heart of Darkness in this particular book, the Joseph Conrad thing, where there's the journey up the river there to go to see Mr. Kurtz. And so there's a very, look, you could not have written this book set any other place. And that's what I think is really important about this particular novel in particular, that it's set in Papua and it could only have been set in Papua. The story that she tells could only have been told there. But it's very interesting that while there aren't many books set in Papua or Papua New Guinea, especially around the Australian colonial period that was there, I was reminded very much of sort of like the British Raj in India. It's the same sort of thing that goes on, but there's a lot more novels written around the period of the Brits in India than we have from Australians in Papua. Mm. It would be good to be able to read more of them, but I just don't know whether very many of them have been written. So this is quite one out of the box. I think that if you want to get a bit of a view about where Australian crime is and where it's come from, this is one of those books that you really need to have read to be able to get a full picture of it. So I'd recommend it. I gave it 4.2 out of 5.
Oh, that's very good. I must have a look at that. So my next book, this is interesting in the sense, I suppose, that I have a plan, as I know that Perry does, of what I'm planning to read, and I've got a to-be-read list, and try to work through that, and it gets bigger every day.
Part of that problem is you, David. You keep coming up with ideas for this podcast, and I've got to try and read around it to catch up with all the stuff that I haven't read in the past.
It's true of both of us, I think. But anyway, the point of what I'm saying is that very occasionally I read a book completely at random out of nowhere, and it's generally because it's been recommended to me by one of the book sites I buy books from. You know, you may like this book, or they're offering a special deal, and a book comes up, and that I think, oh, you know, they're going to give me this for 99 cents as an ebook. I'll give it a try. Anyway, this was actually came through the library website. The library is now closed, but they're pushing their ebooks. And this is a particular book which they, for whatever reason, it's been made available without any limits on how many people can read it at once, which is unusual for libraries. So anyway, it's a book called An Isolated Incident by Emily Maguire. It was published in 2016. Now, I haven't come across Emily Maguire before. She's an Australian author, but she's had a number of books published. She's had 5 previous novels published, starting with one called Taming the Beast in 2004.
Yeah, I've read that one.
Have you? Oh, okay, that's interesting. Mm. Is it good?
Interesting. That's a very weird discussion for another time. Okay. It is certainly not a crime novel. It's basically a novel about the sexual adventures of a young woman, and particularly the way she seems to be attracted to very much older men. So I don't think this is very much like the one that you're going to describe.
Sure. Well, indeed, this isn't so much of a crime novel as a psychological study too, and a study of men's attitude to women and how they treat them. So it's centers around the murder of a young woman called Bella Michaels in a place called Strathdee, which is a rural town. Yeah, in the book is a rural town in New South Wales, and the story is mostly told from the first person point of view of her older sister Chris Rogers, who works as a barmaid in the town. But we also have a storyline which is written in the third person, which centres on May Norman, who's a journalist for a small newspaper in Sydney, who travels to the town to report on the murder and ends up becoming obsessed with the case. So the novel opens with Chris Rogers opening the door to a police officer, and she immediately knows what he's going to tell her, because her sister Bella has been missing for a couple of days. So Chris knows before the policeman tells her that they've found her body, which they have. It's been dumped in the bush not far from the highway, and she's been bashed and sexually assaulted. It really focuses on Chris and her reactions to all of this and how she bears her grief. She's a really interesting character. She's had a very tough life. And the book slowly fills out her backstory of how she was raised and how she sort of really acted as a mother to this much younger sister, Bella. Chris has been married, but she's now separated from her truck driver husband, Nate. But Nate still appears and helps her out and tries to comfort her in her grief and does a great deal to help her. More really than she... she really doesn't show him as much gratitude as he probably deserves for how he tries to look after her. He's very, very considerate of her. But he can only visit her sporadically. Anyway, we eventually find out who killed Bella, but that's not an important focus of the book. It's really about Chris and how she copes with her grief. And we also have this other point of view of the journalist who becomes obsessed and starts to shed some of her journalistic instincts and become more personally involved in the story. So the book also has really a lot of critical things to say about men's attitude and treatment of women, particularly in rural townships like this, but in general. And it started to go a little bit off track for me towards the end when Chris begins to have visions of her dead sister, Bella. Now, that's not at all unusual, an unusual occurrence, of course, with people who have lost people they love. But then it starts to drift into hints of a sort of supernatural connection, and it goes a little beyond that, which I didn't much like that. I thought that was going off track, really. But anyway, that's really sort of a quibble. It's overall, I thought it was pretty well written and an engaging book. So just say one of those books that you came across out of the blue, and thought it was worth a read.
Okay. Yes, she's got a bit of a reputation as being a fine young Australian writer. So probably not so young anymore when you consider
she's
that
been
basically,
for a while.
Sort of 15, 18 years. So you sort of forget that. Well, they're all younger than us, David. I mean,
well,
that
wouldn't
that
be hard, would it?
It's not that hard. But basically, you sort of think that they're new young writers. And then you go and have a look and realise they've been around for 15 years and you think, oh, okay, maybe not so much anymore. So anyway, that's all right. That's good. Look, if they're new to you, if they're new to us.
Yep. Put it down as a good crop of new writers.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to stay in the Australian vein and deal with a couple of books from a newish Australian-Irish writer. I think you've read these as well, because I think you may have mentioned them. These are two books by Dervla McTiernan. She's an Irish-Australian author, born in Ireland, and moved to Perth in Western Australia around the time of the global financial crisis, when Ireland was in a fair bit of financial difficulty. She and her family moved out to Perth, and she's working as a solicitor over there. About 5 or 6 years ago, she decided to take up writing with a bit more seriousness, if you like, sort of put a bit more effort into it. And she's now written three novels featuring Detective Cormac Riley, which are all set in Ireland. I'm going to talk about the first two of them because I've only got through the first two, although the third one has been published this year. So the first one of these, The Ruin, was published in 2018. The second one, The Scholar, in 2019. Now, both these books follow the career of a detective called Cormac Riley, who's been transferred from a high-profile crime unit in Dublin to another police facility in Galway. This is basically just a standard police facility. It's not one looking into levels of terrorism or high security stuff. He's basically taking a step backward because he's returning to his roots. He started out as a young Garda, young policeman in Galway. And also his partner, Dr. Emma Sweeney, has got a job in a large biochemical firm that is based in Galway. So they've moved back to Galway. And these two books follow his work there. Now, before I go on, this is an interesting thing about a lot of crime novels, that when you get to have a look at them, you realise that if... And this isn't true for the Inspector Alan Grant book. It isn't true for Beat about the bones, because there's really no detective. It's just a woman trying to find out, trying to solve the mystery of her husband's death. But when you get down to people that work inside a police organisation, you realise that in order for the crime writer to increase the level of tension, not only just about the case that they're working on, but to give you this view that the detective lives a full life and it's not just, I've got one thing to look at and I'm just going to keep on going, you will find that there are pieces about the person's private life, about their family, but also about the tensions they have with other parts of the legal profession. And they're all different in terms of different parts of the world and the way they do things. If you take things like John Rebus, Ian Rankin's detective, he basically only has to deal with his own department and internal affairs. And internal affairs are always on his back over things. And other people are basically saying, we shouldn't be doing it this way, we should be doing it that way. We don't like your technique, we don't like your methods. So this adds a level of tension to the character. If you go for something like Harry Bosch, the Michael Connelly stuff set in LA, he seems to get a lot of good support from his police department. But his major sources of tension are when people try to sue him for wrongful death or wrongful arrest, or, you know, sort of making too violent an arrest. He has to go through the court system to be able to defend himself about that. Or if he actually crosses paths with the FBI, he also runs into problems with tensions. So it's all a matter of the detective basically having these other tensions around them that increases the whole feeling of the particular book. Cormac Riley's major tensions are that nobody trusts him, because they think, why the hell did this guy leave this high-flying, serious crime unit in Dublin to come back to Galway, of all places, just to work as a detective? So when they first start, they throw him into cold cases. That's all he's doing. He's just checking up to see whether anybody did something wrong or if they found anything that they could work on from old cold cases. Now, as it happens, as I said earlier, that he started in Galway, and the ruin starts with him coming across a young boy and girl in a house where the mother has died. And he realises that the house is sort of fairly squalid. The kids are probably not being looked after terribly well. He takes them, makes sure that they've taken away, looked after, because the mother's dead, the father's completely missing, nobody knows where they are. But he never finds out what happened to the mother. Nothing's ever decided. He goes off to his other career. And then he comes back to Galway. And when he gets back, not soon after he is back, there's a case where somebody appears to have committed suicide by jumping off a bridge in Galway. And it happens to be the young boy, 20 years later, that he rescued from this particular family. And so the police say, well, you know a bit about the background of it. Here you are, you take it, thinking, oh, well, you just close it off because it's just a suicide. The sister, who was 5 or 6 years older, or maybe eight years older than the boy, went missing after the boy had been put into care and disappeared. Everybody thinks she's dead, but then she turns up. She's been back in Australia working in the Kimberley on a sheep station somewhere or other, and has turned up with a fair bit of money and does not believe that he was, the brother, was committed suicide. So she's basically trying to get the police to reinvestigate this thing, and he basically goes on, Cormac Riley, that is, goes on and investigates it. And so you get a really good police procedural with him looking into what had happened in the past, eventually solving what happened to the mother's death, and also working out what happens here. So it's quite, it works really well. The second one, The Scholar, is set about a year later, where Riley's partner, Emma Sweeney, outside the place where she works, finds a dead body in the street. It's a girl that's been killed in a hit and run accident, and so badly disfigured in the hit and run that you can't work out who she is. So the police turn up, search the body, and they find an ID card for the which belongs to the daughter of the billionaire owner of this biochemistry company. And so everybody thinks, oh my God, it's the granddaughter of the billionaire owner. So everybody thinks, oh my God, now we're in trouble. There's just going to be this big political problem with the death of this particular woman. So Riley is thrown the case because he happens to be there at the time. He's the first one called in because his partner called him in. So he's across what's going on here. But then there's the conflict about, is Emma Sweeney one of the major suspects in the particular crime? Because it's obviously a hit and run. It's a murder because sooner or later it becomes quite obvious that the woman was hit, the car went down the road and then backed up and ran over her again just to make sure that the woman was dead. So Riley tries to work out who this particular woman is. He thinks it's the granddaughter, first off, of the billionaire, until he turns up at the granddaughter's house and there she is. And he suddenly realises that things are a lot more complicated than they were going to be. Now, McTiernan really does look after plots very well here. There's some really quite good plotting that goes on in these two particular books. Quite excellently done, well worth people reading, and with the third one now out, best to get into these and start reading them early so that you can catch up and get to the third one. And they're picking up a lot of awards around the world. The Ruin, the first one, won the David Award for Best Novel, which is an award given out by Sisters in Crime for the best novel written by an Australian woman, a best crime novel written by an Australian woman. It won the 2019 Barry Award for the Best Paperback Original. That's a major US crime award. And it also won the 2019 Ned Kelly Award for Best First Novel. So that's a bit of pedigree. And just recently, The Scholar picked up the 2020 International Thriller Award for Best Paperback Original Novel. Mm. So a lot of people around the world really quite like these books, and I would recommend them. My only quibble is, and I'm really getting down to quibbles now, David, right. You know, when you get right down to the level that everything else is really good, and then I've got to give them a rating. So I gave both of these a rating, oddly enough, of 4.0. I gave them exactly the same. And the reason why I didn't push them a little bit higher, I think, is that I didn't really have a view that these needed to be definitively set in Galway. I didn't get that much of a view, other than one or two little bits here and there, that this was actually in Ireland itself. It could have been really set anywhere. I was talking earlier about Beat Not the Bones, having it could only be set in Papua. And you got to get a really good view about the jungle, the people, and the association of how the Australians and the natives deal with each other. The Man in the Queue gives you a really good view of the London theatre scene in Scotland. And the other book that I'm going to talk about later on will also is dealing with a particular location that could only be there. The only quibble I have with this one is I don't actually get that as much as I think we should do. I spoke to my wife about these, who'd read these, and she thought I was just crazy, basically, sort of, oh, come on, you really are dragging the bottom of the barrel to be able to do this. And I said, no, you ever think about the John Rebus book set in Edinburgh? They're seeped in Edinburgh. You come away from those particular books almost being able to walk the streets of Edinburgh, being able to figure out where everything is. And there are bits and pieces of the city that are integral to the plots. I don't find that's the case here. I think it might be because she's a youngish writer just trying to find her feet, trying to work out to make sure that he gets the plots right and gets the characters right. She's got all those bits going. She now just needs to add in a little bit more of Ireland and Galway, and I think she'll do really, really well. Certainly an author to watch.
Hmm. Yes, I think we're lucky to have her come to Australia and write from here. Her work, when it first came out, reminded me a lot of the novels of Tana French, who is also an Irish writer, although not native Irish either. She's an American, I think. Who came to live in Dublin, 20, 30 years ago, I think. But she, all her books are written in Dublin or around Dublin, and features something called the Dublin Murder Squad. At least all but the last of her books does that. And Dervla McTiernan's books certainly reminded me of Tana French, and certainly of an equivalent standard, because I think Tana French's books are terrific. And Dervla McTiernan, I was very excited to think, well, here's another Irish writer who is a crime writer who's going to continue this sort of tradition. So, yeah, it's interesting to compare the two. I must talk about Tana French at some stage.
I'm certainly not trying to put anybody off reading these particular books, because these are wonderful. They're really good police procedurals, and I really enjoyed reading them. But I have a tendency to have an emotional response to books, and sometimes I think something, I'm not quite sure what it is here, that I think could have been slightly better. That's all I'm trying to say. And I think that anybody that reads these books is not going to be wasting their time at all. They're really really quite good.
Yeah, they're both very, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. My next one that I was going to talk about is another Australian crime novel. And this is by Sarah Bailey. And it's called Where the Dead Go. And this is her third novel. This is in a series which features a police detective called Gemma Woodstock. And Sarah Bailey's first novel, her debut novel, was called The Dark Lake, which I think is brilliant. And that's set in the rural New South Wales town of Smithson. And the sequel to that was Into the Night, which was set in Melbourne. And I didn't think that was anywhere near as good. And if you talk about sort of your real sense of place, Into the Night really didn't do it for me, even though it was about the city I live in. A little, but not as much as I would have hoped. So anyway, then we come to this third book. So I think that her second book was one of those victims of that kind of syndrome that a lot of writers get into. They get an absolutely brilliant first book, they get all the plaudits, and then they bring out a second book, which is they struggle to try to hit the same heights. Anyway, I think she's pretty much back to standard, not quite up to the standard of the first book, but better anyway than Into the Night with this book called Where the Dead Go. And when I wrote about The Dark Lake, I said in part that Gemma Woodstock was one of the most psychologically fraught detectives I'd encountered in fiction. She has a very complicated personal life. She has a young son by a man called Scott, but they're not living together, and Scott takes on most of the burden of looking after their son, Ben. She has, a very, very complicated personal life. And like the others in the series, Where the Dead Go is told from her first-person point of view. So we follow Woodstock as she returns to the little town of Smithson for the funeral of this the child's father, Scott, who has died of cancer. We discover that Gemma now has an ongoing relationship with another detective called Max in Sydney, where she's been working for a while. And she plans to go back to Sydney and take her son Ben with her to live there. But before she can return to Sydney, however, at the start of this novel, she's asked to step into a case in Fairhaven, which is a coastal town in northern New South Wales. And what's happened there is that there's a 15-year-old girl has gone missing. And a couple of days after she goes missing, her boyfriend is found murdered. Anyway, so she leaps on this. There are reasons that she particularly wants to take this case up due to a previous case that she failed to solve. So despite the strong advice of her boyfriend Max and her father and just about everyone else around her, she decides that she's going to take on this case in this coastal town and travel to the town with her son Ben in tow. Now, this is literally the same day as the funeral of this young child's father. So, this poor boy is, of course, struggling to deal with his grief and the loss of his father. And so her move seems to be rather reckless. But she seems to feel that getting out of Smithson and the constant reminders of Ben's father is the best way to help the child overcome his grief. I'm not sure about that. The plot was a bit slow to take off, but by about the middle of the book, I was really quite engaged in the mystery of what had happened in this town. And it wasn't by any means obvious to me how it was going to be solved. because the case isn't by any means as straightforward as it first seems. The girl who goes missing had apparently just broken up with this boyfriend, and a few days later his body is found murdered and has been hit with some sort of blunt instrument, and suspicion naturally falls on this girl's father. But then there's an English backpacker they discover who is trying to get close to the girl who's gone missing, and he's found to have abruptly left the town shortly after she goes missing. And he's left all his friends behind and just headed off somewhere else. And they have to kind of track him down, trace him, work out where he is. So more and more complications arise, and there emerges a connection with the trade in illicit drugs in the town, possibly facilitated by the doctor who runs the local hospital. So it all gets very complicated. And because the book's written in the first person, we, of course, spend a lot of time inside Gemma's head as she struggles to overcome her own psychological issues and at the same time protect and comfort her son Ben and still solve the case. But she's one of those characters which is very much like Martin Skarsgård, the character Martin Skarsgård in Chris Hammer's book Silver, where every so often you want to shake them by the shoulders and say, listen, you're being so bloody stupid. But, you know, they don't pay any attention. But anyway, it all sort of works out. And in the end, the crime is solved, and we find out what has happened to the girl who went missing and who killed the boyfriend, and all seems to resolve itself. So it was pretty enjoyable, I say, but still not quite as good as her first book, which was stellar, really. So yeah, I enjoyed it. Anyway, she's certainly an author I'll be keeping a very close eye on in the future as she writes other books.
Isn't it interesting that we've got Bailey, Jane Harper and McTiernan all having written three novels around about the same amount of time?
Yes.
And so 3 or 4 years ago there was a big surge of those three. Prior to that was Kenneth Fox, who's still going incredibly strong.
Yes.
We've got a surfeit of riches.
Yes, we're blessed with good female writers.
Yeah,
Australian writers.
Don't seem to be as many young male writers around writing them. I know that Chris Hammer's one that is doing quite well, but you've got reservations about
his
particular books. No, that's okay. I'll have to read them and come back to you and let you know. But it's interesting that those three are all coming along very well in a similar sort of time frame. And I think that if people want to get a bit of an idea about what's happening in Australian crime writing at the moment, those three are ones that are worth having a look at and trying to keep up on. But you've got to get started, because you're already, if you haven't read any of them yet, you're already 9 books behind. And that takes a little while to catch up. So yeah, one a month, sure. And it's almost a year. And by the time you get through those 9, there'll be another 3 of them stacked up.
That's right.
Well, I want to move to a little bit further away from Australia than we've been so far, but I want to move to the Shetland Islands. And the book I want to read here, I want to talk about here, is Raven Black by Anne Cleves, which was written in 2006. This is the first of the Shetland Island series, starring Detective Inspector Jimmy Perez. Fantastic name. Mm-hmm. This particular book, Raven Black, won this Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger Award in 2006, which is their sort of the English Crime Writers Hugo Award, if you like. It's the top of the tree for them. It's also, people will recognise this as being, and Jimmy Perez, as it's been made into a four or five seasons of a program called Shetland, where Jimmy Perez is the main character. The adaptation isn't the same as the books. It looks like some parts of this particular book have appeared in the first season, but there are subtle differences between the books and the TV series. But in general, it's set on Shetland. And for this particular book, the location is absolutely and utterly important. Again, it's one of those things where, you could have shifted it to the Faroe Islands and you could possibly have done it in Iceland, but emphasis would have been slightly different. But you really need it in one of those very small enclosed communities where everybody knows everybody and it's pretty isolated, as the Shetland Islands generally are. Now, Jimmy Perez, great name, and it does actually come out, as I said earlier, it's a great name, it does come out that he's descended from a sailor who was shipwrecked off the Shetland Islands as a result of the Spanish Armada. As you remember, David, the Spanish Armada took off from France heading over towards England and got clobbered with a gigantic gale that swept up the English Channel and swept them all the way right up the side, up the east coast of England, up towards Scotland.
And by I'm not sure I remember that.
But you know the story. Yes. And anyway, I'm not a shimmy of that old. But anyway, so basically what ended up happening was the ships basically got so far up, there was no point trying to turn around and come back against the gale, that they decided to go around all the way right around the top and go all the way right through. I don't think very many of them made it back. A lot of them were shipwrecked on Scotland, Shetland, Ireland, and so on. But anyway, here's the result of a long line of Perezes that have come down all the way through. Now, he originally grew up on the Isle of Fair Isle, which is halfway between Shetland and Scotland. He went to school on Shetland. After he went to school, he became a police officer and was living in Aberdeen. His marriage breaks up. I think they lose a child. His marriage breaks up. He decides to go back to Shetland. His ex-wife moves down to the borders with the UK. So he's back there in this sort of small, cosy little police station in Shetland when the body of a young girl, well, she's sort of, you know, 16, 17, so she's near the end of high school, is found strangled in a field. Now, there are no footmarks around her, but it has been snowing. And oddly enough, there's snow all over the body, but not on the face. Now, as it's happened about 8 years previously to this particular death, a young girl of about 6 or 7 went missing and was never found. The main suspect for that particular murder of that young girl was a guy called Magnus Tate, who's a strange, lonely old bloke who lives in a small farmhouse, which is right by the field where Catherine Ross, the 16-17-year-old, has just been found. The police go to interview him and it becomes pretty obvious that he found her and wiped the snow off her face. When he was asked why he did that, he said, well, I couldn't just leave her there like that, but I couldn't do anything for her because she was dead. Well, why didn't you ring us? I don't have a telephone. There's no telephone nearby. I don't have a telephone. But he's a strange, lonely guy. His mother and younger sister have both died. He's there on his own, living in this small place, and everybody thinks that he's the culprit. Now, the interesting thing about this particular book is that Anne Cleaves has written a number of books prior to this in various other things. I think she also wrote the Vera books as well, which has also been... Maybe. I'll probably get in trouble for that as well, David. So anyway, I don't really know all that much about Vera, but there we go. Anyway, so she's written a number of books prior to this and knows how to handle a crime novel. So the idea is that a lot of times you set up a suspect so that the reader basically goes, yeah, yeah, okay, it's that particular person. Yeah, it looks pretty obvious. Why is this book so bloody long? Is this particular... Hang on a minute. There's a few things coming up that they start to find, well, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. He couldn't have done that. He couldn't have done this. And then the reader slowly moves away from that particular suspect and then fixates on somebody else who seems to be the other one. This must be this person then. And she stays with that particular person right through to the very end. And it's only in the very last chapter of the book that suddenly it all comes together and Perez is able to say, yep, bang, he knows exactly who it is. It's handled very, very well, and you kick yourself because you think, oh, I should have seen this right from the very start. I talked to my wife about this book and she said, well, I picked it. But then she's always picking these things. She's read so many crime novels over the journey. She just goes, yeah, yeah, well, it's got to be that person because that fits the formula. I'm not that au fait with all the nuances, but I really like the way the author was able to integrate the whole of the sort of Shetland cultural community into this particular crime, to lead the reader along to one suspect and then another before finally bringing the final suspect, the culprit, to view, and then it all fits in and it all makes sense. And I thought she's done very, very well with this. It's well paced, it's well written, great locations, everything you want in a police procedural. It's I think there's about 8 in the series. I'll be gradually working my way through them. I think I'd recommend them to everybody. I gave this one about a 4.2.
Okay, very good. Well, you've talked quite a few times in this episode, Perry, about the importance of place and the giving people a sense of place, and the idea that a book ideally set in a place where you can't imagine it being set anywhere else. And indeed, that's very true of the book I'm going to talk about, which is Truth by Peter Temple. And it's all set in the city of Melbourne, Victoria. And it's very much a book about the place. It's a bit of a cliche to say it, but it's one of those stories where the city itself is kind of a character in the story. But it's quite true, I think. So it's a very interesting depiction of somewhere which is very familiar to Perry and I. And it's interesting to see it cast in this light, because we see very much the gritty side of Melbourne, that's for sure, and the crime scene here. The Truth is an interesting book because it won the Miles Franklin Award in 2010, which is Australia's premier literary award. And as far as we know, it's the first genre novel to win that award. It's the sequel to Temple's novel, The Broken Shore, which I talked about on the podcast a few episodes ago, which I really liked. But it's only a sequel in the sense that several of the characters are the same between the two books. This one centres on the character of Stephen Villani, who was the head of the Homicide Department of Victoria Police. I'm not sure whether one should say Homicide Department or Homicide Squad, but anyway, he's in charge of Homicide. And he's a really sort of hardened, sardonic character. He sort of deals with some of his colleagues in a very sort of tough and brusque sort of way. He's a workaholic who's dedicated to the job. But as the novel progresses, we get more and more of his backstory, and we sort of learn how he came to be the way he is. And he has two daughters, and I think a son as well, but the son's living overseas. But he's got two daughters who are living at home, and he's kind of certainly distanced from his wife, who travels to do, I think she's a cinematographer, or she produces documentaries, something like that, and she's away a lot of the time. Anyway, early in this novel, his youngest daughter, who's only 15 years old, runs away from home. And a lot of his anxiety throughout the book, of course, centres around trying to find her and make her safe. But as the story opens, Villani is returning from a gory crime scene. They're crossing the Westgate Bridge, and one of his colleagues tells a story of how his father was on the Westgate Bridge when it collapsed during construction quite a few years ago, decades ago. Anyway, they're alerted to a death in very suspicious circumstances in a newly built high-rise tower. And this new tower is very fancy, and it incorporates a casino, restaurants and residential apartments, very high-end residential apartments. In one of these apartments, a young woman has been found dead naked in the bath with a broken neck and other injuries. But to say that the building owners and managers are uncooperative would be an understatement. They really just want to do anything they can to avoid any bad publicity and don't even want it to be considered to be a murder. It could have been an accident. You know. And they're really trying to, not really helpful at all. And the identity of this young woman is unknown and remains so for most of the book. Interestingly enough, none of the tower's fancy security systems were working properly at the time of the murder, so there's very little evidence of what went on. But the building owners, say, really resist Villani getting involved in this, and they have high-level contacts in the government, and they use them to pressure Villani to back off, which he obviously resists as much as he possibly can. Meanwhile, there's another crime is uncovered. There's a grisly find in a shed in Oakley. Three men are found dead. Two of them have been terribly tortured and strung up, or strung up and then tortured. It looks like some sort of drug-related execution. So as we go through the story, these two cases become sort of intertwined, and we get to see what the solution is and why things have occurred. But as Villani struggles to solve the crimes, he's also constantly anxious about his father, as well as his daughter, who's gone missing and still hasn't turned up. He's very anxious about his father, who lives in the countryside, and there are bushfires. It's summer, and the huge bushfires are blazing and getting closer and closer to where his father lives. And he's got a very sort of odd relationship with his father, who kind of left him a lot of the time to look after his younger brothers when he was only a kid himself. And his father traveled, and I think he was a truck driver and things, and he had to leave Stephen Villani at home with his brothers to look after them. And so Villani's kind of grown up tough, and there's a lot of background about that. And it's really very much a novel of character, and about how we are raised shapes us as we become adults. Anyway, as the book progresses, Villani discovers that the case in the high-rise tower is tied up with corruption inside the government and within the police force. And in fact, Villani himself isn't a clean skin. Progressively get to learn that he was involved in an incident where the police essentially executed a criminal, and he's helped cover up this case. So he's no clean skin himself. And we get more and more details of this corruption that's gone on both in the police force and the government, and why this case is in the tower has had to be kind of covered up and suppressed. It's all to do with the way the owners of the building are dealing with the government. So it's a very gritty, honest novel about policing and crime, and about the impact of all that on characters like Villani. And no one comes out very clean at the end. So I really liked it. It's a great book. You can see why it won the award. It makes me want to hunt up Peter Temple's other books, those featuring Jack Irish, who, by the way, makes a very brief cameo appearance in this book. But that's about all. So, yeah, I thoroughly recommend this. It's really an excellent novel.
I was going to mention the Jack Irish novels on the basis of, again, location. You know, where he basically hangs out in the pub with these three old guys that are sitting up at the bar, old ex-Fitzroy diehards who have now had to change their allegiances when their football team disintegrated. Look, Temple's a great loss. He was a wonderful writer. There's some fantastic stuff that he's done. All we can do really is be thankful for what he left us. But he left too early a couple of years back, died in his early 70s. You know, he still had a lot of work left to do, I think. And it's just a bit of a shame that he's not around. But all things must pass, David. All things must pass. Indeed. But I was impressed with all of the, was it five books that I read that I talked about here. All enjoyed them all, and anybody listening to this who decided to read any of those is not going to be disappointed by what they get. We can quibble all we like, and we do, because that's what we like doing, David.
Right,
finding little things to have a bit of a chat about. But I think I was happy I read all of them.
Yeah, I enjoyed all the books I read. So yeah, and I say it's nice to get a bit of a break from the science fiction genre and look at a different genre for a while.
Yep, we'll have to look at crime again sometime later in the year or early next.
Yeah, or early next, indeed.
Okay, David, well, that brings us pretty close to the end of this particular episode. We've carried on quite long enough, well over the hour yet again, but it's been a good one and an enjoyable one. Next episode, David, we'll be moving away from books and looking at three films by one particular director.
Oh, yes, we are. Of course we are. Yes, we are. We won't give it away.
No, we won't give it away, but we're dealing with one particular director next time, and then after that we'll be back into science fiction again. Indeed. I believe. So, bit to look forward to. So, until then, David, we'll see you later.
Indeed. Enjoy. Catch you later. See you. We'll see you all in 2 weeks' time.
Yep. Goodbye. See you then.
Bye-bye.